I want to start today a little strangely. We're going to watch a video. A couple weeks ago, I got the opportunity to spend a day in Chicago with an author that I have followed for a long time named Ed Stetzer. And Ed talks a lot about how we should be people who no longer act as if we are the majority in America. There's never actually been a time when more than 50% of people in America were actively involved in a church, actively involved in their Christian faith. But there have been many times when more than 50% of people on a survey would say that they were Christians. And when that has happened, that has given us the courage to then act as if we are the majority. And the problem is, the way you do mission, the way you do ministry when you are the majority is different than you do when you are the minority. And so what Ed is telling us is that it is time for us not to act as if we have all the power, but to instead approach culture as if we are the minority. What that means is that we have to become missionaries. And missionaries act differently, approach their mission in a different way than people who think that they're in the majority. The first thing that missionaries do is they study the culture in which they are going to minister to. They figure out who is their target audience. They figure out what's going on in their brains and what are their habits and what language do they speak and what do they value and those things. And I think it is our job, our role in society today as Christians, as active Christians, to study our culture, to figure out why. Because have you ever watched the news and you just think, how could you possibly come to that conclusion? How does your brain work? I do not understand how you could come to that conclusion. And it is because they are working from a totally different worldview. And we have got to figure out what is the worldview of our culture. And I don't think we've spent enough time talking about it as a church. And one of the ways you do that is you listen to them. And so today I want to listen to a video of a guy who's got the ear of our culture, who has slowly over the years begun to shape people's minds about many things, one of which is about God. He is an atheist named Bill Maher. He's got millions of people who listen to him on a regular basis, and I think it's important that we know what he's saying. Let me give you a PG-13. This guy is vulgar. We've tried to edit out a lot of what he says wrong. I think we've edited out all the really vulgar things, but watch this.
Last week, Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively apologized for having their wedding 8 years ago at a plantation in South Carolina. And while I'm sure we could all do better in being aware of the presence of racism, including in the past, if this is the new rule, it's going to be hard to go to a lot of places in the South. It was kind of one big plantation. And not just the South. The Stock Exchange is two blocks from New York's first slave market. And in 1991, construction on a new building in Lower Manhattan unearthed a massive slave burial ground from the 17th century. Among the businesses that stand over that ground today are a dance studio and a ballet academy. So people are literally dancing on those graves. Because America is poltergeist. We're all 6 degrees from genocidal. If we start turning history into a big game of guilt by association, it never ends. Are we really going to make everyone apologize for standing somewhere that humans used to stand when they were even more barbaric than they are now? Ryan Reynolds said of his wedding, "It's something we'll always be deeply unreservedly sorry for." Yeah, the Green Lantern was a giant mistake. This was you got married at a beautiful venue you saw on Pinterest. Look, every wedding, every funeral, every slip and slide on this blood-soaked land is inappropriate. The country itself is named after a slave trader named Amerigo. But we can't just pack up our government and pretend none of this country ever happened. Here's a crazy idea. Let's live in the present and make the future better. Of course, tear down statues of Confederate traitors. But in San Francisco, protesters tore down one of Grant, because Grant was once gifted a slave who he then freed. Okay, not a perfect score, but Grant was the guy who kicked the other statues you've been tearing down. You know, while they were alive and could fight back. A little braver, I'd say, There's even a drive to remove a statue of Lincoln at the University of Wisconsin because, as one student put it, I just think he did, you know, some good things, but the bad things he's done definitely outweighs them. Yeah, I wish I had been raised with the kind of self-esteem parents give their kids these days, where you can think that when it comes to accomplishments and racial justice, you're just a little bit better than Abraham Lincoln. Washington and Jefferson are also up for cancellation because they owned slaves. And being a product of your time, that's not an excuse anymore. But if that's the case, if being a product of your time is no longer an excuse, what do you have to say about this guy and his dad? He was really strict. And neither one of them had any problem whatsoever with slavery. The Confederacy used the Bible to justify their cause because it has plenty of passages from both Testaments to back them up. Slaves, obey your earthly masters. Slaves, be obedient to your human masters. Slaves, submit yourself to your masters. You see a pattern? If we're going to be consistent, I think we're going to have to cancel God. Jesus himself says at one point in the Bible, the servant who knows the master's will and does not do what the master wants will be beaten with many blows. Thanks, Son of God. Would you let those words slide if it was somebody's tweet today? Jesus did heal a slave once, but not to free him, to get him back working. Because this is how slavery was back then. They didn't see it as a problem because no one did. And if you had been back there, you wouldn't have either. You're not better than Jesus or Ulysses S. Grant. You just came later. But I gotta say that Jesus, you know, being God and all, really should have known better. So when he comes back to judge the living and the dead, I say he's got a lot of explaining to do. Like, hey, you were always performing miracles. Instead of the bar tricks with the loaves and the wine, why didn't you zap the chains off a slave? With all the preachings and the sermons on mounts, why not one time throw in a little, oh, and this whole people owning other people thing? That's not right. But no, nada. On the subject of slavery, Jesus says, sweet. So first thing when he gets back is, we're going to need an apology. And I mean a real apology. On any of this, I'm sorry if my condoning of slavery caused offense. Mm-mm. And then I think rehab would be in order. And also sensitivity training. Oh, he can forget about hosting the Oscars.
Is that fun? Today, my goal is not to talk about atheists. To be honest with you, there's not that many atheists statistically in the world. There's a lot of people that talk about the few atheists that they are, and they sell a lot of books, but that's mostly to Christians. My goal is to talk about politics because the odds of saying anything that you would all agree about is impossible. But what I do want to talk about is this fake Jesus that our culture has created, that Bill Maher talks about. These cherry-picked statements and out-of-context statements and false ideas that people are talking about Jesus is very dangerous. And the only way to fight the battle against that is not just to be so incredibly aware of who Jesus is and who Jesus was and how he lived his life and the things that he said, but also to live our lives like he lived his life. Because Jesus, he interacted with a lot of people in his life, like Bill Maher, like on a regular basis. So how did he interact with them? There are a lot of people that said false things about him when he was alive. What did he say to them? Today, I want to take a look at some of the ways that Jesus interacted with people like this. One of the stories we're going to look at is in the book of Luke, and it goes like this. When Jesus came to the village of Nazareth, his home, his boyhood home. And remember, you're thinking, wait, isn't Jesus' boyhood home Bethlehem? No, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Why was he in Bethlehem? For the census. Jesus' family did the census. Have you? Mm-hmm. So So Jesus is in Bethlehem, fulfills a prophecy by being born in Bethlehem, and then he is fleeing away from Herod the Great, so he goes to Egypt. He's only in Egypt for a little while. Then he moves back to Nazareth, his hometown, and that's actually where he's raised. And so this story is actually Jesus going home for, he's on vacation to home at his boyhood home in Nazareth. So he, Jesus, went as usual to the synagogue on the Sabbath. And he stood up to read the scriptures. Would somebody please tell my wife, Darcy, that Jesus went to church on vacation? Because we have this argument every vacation. She wants to go to the beach, and I want to go visit a church. I'll tell you who's a better Christian. No, just kidding. Beach. Okay, anyway, moving on. The scroll of Isaiah, the prophet, was handed to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where this was written. Now, Isaiah is a prophet, right? Isaiah prophesied a couple hundred years before Jesus was born that Jesus would come, that a Messiah would come. And Jesus today, so pay attention, Jesus is preaching the sermon. And the passage that Jesus is using to preach his sermon is from Isaiah. So the prophesied Messiah is quoting the prophet. And now it goes like this. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. Good news to the poor is Jesus' message. He has sent me what? He has sent me to proclaim that captives will be released, Bill Maher. Bill Maher's seminary education must have skipped the book of Isaiah and the book of Luke when Jesus condemned slavery, one of the multiple times that he did. In fact, these are the passages that were often used by the abolitionists, by Abraham Lincoln, by the others who fought against slavery in order to fight against slavery. I believe that it weren't for Christ, and if it weren't for his followers, Christians, we would still have slavery in America today, at least a little bit more predominantly than we do. It's because Christians were the one who started the movement. Thank you, Christians. I have come to proclaim that the blind will see, that the oppressed will be set free, that the oppressed will be set free, Bill Maher, and that the time of the Lord's favor has come. The Messiah that Isaiah foretold is here, Jesus is saying. The time of the Lord's favor is here. And he rolled up the scroll, handed it back to the attendant, and dropped a mic. Sat down. That's a mic drop moment in scripture if I've ever seen one. Hey, this guy that you've been waiting for, this prophesied Messiah, I am him. If you just look throughout history, you will see person after person who decided that Jesus was telling the truth when he claimed to be the Messiah. And this mission of Christ is not just the mission that he lived when he was here on earth, but it is the mission that he sent us on. If you find outcasts, serve them. If you find people are marginalized, help them, give to them, be generous to them, and do everything you can to lift them up. If you find a slave, find a way to set him free. And all of the eyes in the synagogue looked at him intently. Because this was revolutionary. Bill Maher was right about one thing. It was not normal in his time to think slavery was wrong, but Jesus did. And they all stared at him like, what are you saying, crazy person? Bill Maher won't admit it, but Christ and his followers have been the greatest force for good in human history. Just track the origin of almost every great nonprofit of history. All the great hospitals and schools and charities, just track their origins. Figure out who started them, and I'll tell you what you'll find. You'll find a Christian who was motivated by his Christian mission to help people, to love people. Then he began to speak to them. The scripture you've just heard has been fulfilled this very day. That Messiah that Isaiah was talking about, I'm him. And this next verse blows my mind because Jesus has just claimed to be the Messiah. That's blasphemy. They should have rejected him. But even then, after saying this, everyone spoke well of him and was amazed by the gracious words that came from his lips. How can this be, they asked. Remember, he's in his hometown. Isn't this Joseph's son? We know him. They watched him grow up. But Jesus grew up. And when he started his ministry, he did not stay home. He went on a mission, and he went to the places that nobody else would go to. He went to town after town, proclaiming the good news of the Messiah's arrival on the scene. One of the places that Jesus went to while he was here on earth was a place called Caesarea Philippi. And Caesarea Philippi was a forbidden place. Jews didn't go there. They weren't supposed to anyway. They did. They snuck off and went there for bad reasons. But Matthew tells us this story. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, now let me give you a background on the city of Caesarea Philippi, because it's a crazy place. This city was forbidden by the Jews because it was built around this cave, and this cave, they believed, was a spiritual cave. This is the cave today. And this city was built around the cave because ever since about 800 BC, you can read about that when you read about the life of Jeroboam, about 800 BC as a place where people would come to worship false gods. Here are a few examples of the false gods they worshiped. Jeroboam set up this golden calf, and they worshiped it here at this cave. The Canaanites worshiped the god Baal or Baal, and they would actually sacrifice their children to this statue in worship of this statue. In order to appease this statue, they would kill their children. There was a temple set up next to this god Baal, and it was called the Temple of the Dancing Goats. In the Temple of the Dancing Goats, they had public orgies. Everybody's involved. Everybody's invited. Public for anyone to join. This is where temple prostitution really took hold and spread around the world. Then there was this god. This is the god Pan. And I would just ask you not to Google the god Pan, because this is disgusting stuff that happened in worship of the god Pan. People of this time would literally take their kids into this cave that had water in it, and they would drown their kids as sacrifices to Pan. Because back then, people believed that these gods lived in hell, or at least had access to hell, and they believed that this cave was actually an entrance to the underworld. So they called the cave the Gates of Hell. This was the name of this cave at Caesarea Philippi, the Gates of Hell. Not in English. Because they believed that this literally led to hell. The crazy thing is that part of the reason why they thought so much about this cave is that this was the main contributor to the Jordan River. This was the starting point of the Jordan River. There's a lot of foreshadowing there that we don't have time to get into. And it is here, at this cave, at the Gates of Hell, at the beginning point of the Jordan River, it is here that Jesus chose to ask his disciples this question. Who do people say that I am? Who do people say that the Son of Man is? Hey, what are the rumors about me? What are the opinions? What are people saying? Well, they replied, some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and others say Jeremiah, or one of the other prophets. In other words, people don't agree. Bill Maher thinks you're one thing, the Jews think you're another thing, the Muslims think you're another thing. There's just different rumors about who you are. Then Jesus asked them, but who do you? Who do you say I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. You are the one that Isaiah told us to watch for. You are the one who would come and set captives free. Jesus replied, "You are blessed, Simon, son of John, because my Father in heaven has revealed this to you. You did not learn this from any human being. Now I say to you that you are Peter, which means rock." In other words, Jesus is doing a metaphor. He does this all the time. "Which means rock. And upon this rock, I will build my church. And upon this rock, I will build my church." And remember where Jesus is sitting when he says this. What rock is Jesus talking about? He is literally sitting on a rock outside the gates of hell. It looks like this today. Next slide. We're going there at the end of December. If anybody wants to go with us, you'd have to register soon, but registration is not closed. We're going to go to this rock. And Jesus says, "Upon this rock, I'm going to build my church at the gates of hell." In other words, Jesus is saying, we're not going to find some cave to hide away in. We're not going to shelter. We're not going to find a safe home or somebody rich enough that can build a big home that we can all fit in. And we're going to hide from the world and only let Christians in. And only if you're good enough, you can be one of us. And he's saying, we're going to do battle, Christians. And we're going to do battle at the gates of hell. But we're going to do it in a unique way. We're going to do it by loving people, by serving people, by setting captives free. And when we build our church at the gates of hell, all the powers of hell will not conquer it. Because they're worried. I mean, they're already in a place they're not supposed to be. This place is forbidden. There's gods that they think are powerful all around them. Is our God as powerful as this one? And what happens if there's some battle? Are we on the winning or are we on the losing side? And Jesus says, all the powers of hell will not conquer this church that we're building at the gates of hell. On this rock, I am building my church. So church, what do? We have seen 2,000 years of this fighting, of this battle, fighting evil. The church was built at the gates of hell, and it's been pushing back the gates of hell ever since Jesus declared that it would. Back then, they had child sacrifice to their gods. Today, we have something that's not quite so overt. We just call it abortion. They had legal slavery, and we've won some battles in this area, but there's still battles to be won. Today, we have illegal slavery. They had public orgies, and we've outlawed a lot of things, especially in Western culture, that we've said certain kind of sexual behaviors or paid sexual acts are illegal. So we've made some things illegal. They also had things like temple prostitutes, and it was just disgusting. And we've pushed back hell's gates a little bit, but we still have things like pornography. It's still running rampant. We also have rampant greed and divisive politics and hate and anger in our world. Like, we just can't even measure. But the church is built to stand firm and fight those evils. So what do? We live our life on mission. And this is what Jesus did. He fought in a way that was unique. He fought those evils in a way that nobody had ever seen. He fought those evils in a way that was attractive. He's sitting there fighting these evils, and everybody's speaking well of him, it says. Everyone spoke well of him and was amazed by his gracious fighting, by the gracious words that came from his lips. Do we like to fight the way the world fights, with hatred and anger and violence and name-calling and all that junk? And Jesus taught us to fight the Bill Maher's of his world in a totally different way, with love and kindness and like irrational generosity. Christians, it is time for us to adopt a Christ-like missional identity, an identity of love and compassion. Become who you're supposed to become so you can do what you're supposed to do, what you were created to do. Be like Christ and live on mission do it at the gates of hell. Not in a safe, accusatory. We're going to create a bubble and not let people that aren't like us in kind of way. We often think that mission work or ministry is what pastors are called to do. That's not Christ-like. Pastors are, or the paid ministers are called to do those things as well. But Christians, we are all called to live on this mission that Jesus called us to. We are all pastors. So will you join the ministry? You'll probably have to sacrifice something for it. You'll probably have to do something you don't want to do or don't feel like doing. You'll probably have to give up something. It's usually not going to be easy, but it will give you peace. It will give you hope. It will give you purpose that you can't get anywhere else. When Jesus calls people to live on mission, he does it something like this. He says, this is the story of him calling some of the disciples. While walking by the Sea of the Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting out nets into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." Right now, you get paid to fish for fish. But if you will follow me, I will make you into something different than you are. I will make you fishers of men. Now you're fishermen, then you will be fishers of men. Side note, as New Lifers, this is our mission statement. Come and become. Come as you are, and I'll make you into something different. Come as you are and become who you were created to be. Become a fisher of men. And what did they do? Immediately they left their nets and followed him. So how much were the disciples paid to follow Jesus? How much were the disciples paid to be fishers of men? Zero. Nothing. They weren't the paid pastors. The disciples were the ones who said, "We're actually going to leave our income behind in order to follow you. Instead of getting paid, instead, we are going to leave behind our father and we're going to leave behind our family business to give our lives for this mission." So the question then becomes to us Christians, what are we willing to sacrifice for? What mission are we willing to give ourselves to? What mission are we willing to give our lives to? Watch this.
Little baby. Hey, come over, little baby. Why are you scared? Hey, look at me. I love you. Miss you. Who is it?
Who is that?
Look here. It's me. Hey, little baby.
Who is that?
Hi.
Who is it?
This police officer gives himself to a mission that he believed it was worth sacrificing for, and it required something of him. It took a sacrifice. He had to give up something to live on that mission, but he did it because he wanted to sacrifice for other people. So he did it. And at the end, there was a reunion that made it all worthwhile, right? At the end, he realized that he had sacrificed for something worth sacrificing for. The reunion is worth the sacrifice. What's worth sacrificing it for you? Darcy just told me that June Land, who's one of our volunteers down in Kids Zone, I'd point at her, but she's down there volunteering right now, has volunteered in Kids Zone 1,996 Sundays. She is 4 Sundays away from 2,000 Sundays volunteering. What? Why? Is June Land crazy? What is she doing? Does she just like punishment? Just kidding. But that would be punishment for me. But she has decided there is a mission worth sacrificing for, worth giving herself to. And she's had to give up some things. I know specifically of some things that she's had to give up to volunteer in Kids Zone. But she does it because she believes it's a mission worth sacrificing for. In fact, I told the same story in first service, and a couple teenagers after the service come up and say, "Yep, I'm a Christian because of June Land." Can you imagine what the reunion is going to be like when June Land is in heaven? And one by one, through the gates of heaven, come these people who get to be there because she shared the good news with them. Can you imagine what the emotions and excitement and what the reunion will look like when June Land gets to worship God together in his presence because she decided in this life that it was worth sacrificing for? I can't imagine that. It is a mission and it is a reunion that I've decided I will give my whole life to. No matter what I have to give up, it is all worth that. And as I look around this room, I see a lot of people who have time and time again sacrificed, given up. They didn't do the things that their neighbors were doing. They gave up an option of doing something fun because they had decided, they had committed themselves to a mission that they felt like was worth sacrificing for. And let me tell you, doing battle at the gates of hell is going to take that kind of sacrifice. You can't do battle at the gates of hell half-heartedly. You can't just be one foot in, one foot out. I'm going to kind of be slightly a Christian. We need sold out, on fire, passionate Christians who are willing to sacrifice everything for that mission. Because I promise you, this life is not all there is. There is more. We don't just die and end up turning into dirt, as Bill Maher would say. There is a mission we're sacrificing for because there is a reunion at the end that will make it all worth it. God, today I thank you for how your grace has given us the chance to be a part of something that's bigger and better than we are. God, I'm sorry for when I've fallen short. I am sorry for when I've made it about me. I am sorry when my actions have been more selfish than selfless. God, would you give me the courage to do battle at the gates of hell by helping those who cannot help themselves, for standing up for those who cannot stand up for themselves, for loving people who need you so desperately. God, give me eyes to see the world as you see the world. To fix my eyes on things above and not on things of this earth. God, make me who you created me to be. I love you and thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for tuning in to New Life Gillette. For more information, visit us on the web at www.newlifegillette.com. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And always remember, Jesus loves you very much, and he died to give you new life.